What's that, man? To the Flood Resilience Committee for Tuesday, September 2023. It's good to see everybody there. And I just want to make a plug. One, we have our new emergency coordinator in the room, Shannon in the back. And she did a great job. But things like last week are a reminder of why municipalities are reminded to have a standing flood resilience committee. Numbers are getting different. We won't have a global climate change debate, but observed local things are different, and we got to deal with it. And, you know, you're just sitting there just reminded, you know, when we saw that tide, and I don't know if anybody predicted the rainfall amount exactly. I don't know if they ever do. But it's good that we have this, and I appreciate the work that y'all all do. And Kevin Mitchell, I appreciate your spearheading and being our point man on all of this. And it's just a reminder, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's committee day, we got another agenda. But these things are getting more and more serious. So thank you all for serving on this committee. Item 2, approval of the minutes from our July 31st meeting. Do we have a motion?
Move for approval, Mr. Chairman.
Motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right. The minutes are approved. Item 3 is public comments. If you're here to make a public comment, please come forward. Give name and address. Anybody? If not, all right, we will close item 3. Item 4, continued discussion of building practices in flood zones.
Mayor, we're going to have Katie come up and continue the discussion and make sure we staying on point with what your desire is.
And just for reference, we had this conversation. Was it last month?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Or was it July?
It was last month.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Of course. So like Brad said, just continuing discussion. Just a little recap or outline of what we'll discuss. So recap of last presentation, looking at a similar regulation effect on the town, some stormwater management review of what we currently do. Looking at the state resilience plan and recommendations, make sure that we tie whatever we're doing to that recent document, and then potential stormwater management improvements. So recap, City of Charleston passed a prohibition of slab-on-grade homes for single-family in a flood zone with the intent of limiting fill and promoting natural storage through crawl spaces. The town already has a lot of existing design requirements. Pre and post stormwater drainage, 2-foot freeboard, we participate in the community rating system, and then we have a limitation on enclosures that we require 40% open louvers. Some data from last presentation, 3% of the parcels in a flood zone are undeveloped, so that's 535 of them, and have a potential to be affected by a fill restriction ordinance. So
a real quick clarification back on this 2 feet of freeboard.
Yes, sir.
I just want to assume, but I'm not certain, that nothing, that doesn't just mean the floor, right? That means anything mechanical, any yep. ductwork,
any HVAC, electrical panel, anything that could be damaged by water that's under base flood plus 2 feet, either needs to be elevated or have class 4 and 5 building materials, basically no OSB rated to be submerged underwater.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. So if we had similar regulation based on what the city of Charleston does, we wanted further clarification on teardowns in a flood zone. So last year we had 2 teardowns and rebuilds that were in a flood zone total out of the whole year. And that were then rebuilt. So there were multiple that were torn down, but they haven't been rebuilt yet or just aren't going to. So accordingly, restrictions on fill for these projects would be minimal as it relates to the housing stock. And usually when these houses are rebuilt, they're rebuilt to those higher standards. So they're typically not slab on grade homes. If we looked at the 535 remaining parcels, they could all be slab on grade construction, but it's improbable. Based on just parcel elevation and hydrology, foundation costs to the property owner. People are wanting to elevate anyway, just that's their preference, appearance and function. And just the ease of renovation. It's easier to expand a house, have maintenance or whatever. If you don't have a slab, it's easier to do that maintenance with the crawl space. So that's just what we are seeing with the town, some data in the last year. Wouldn't be a ton of impact if we were to pass a similar ordinance from the city of Charleston. Kevin, do you want to talk about?
Thank you, Katie. Just very briefly, I think it's a good opportunity to discuss what the town actually does internally when land development occurs. There is a two-step process. We actually look at the same area twice in our plans before it goes vertical. The first step is our design review team reviews the technical aspects of the land development. That's the ponds, the stormwater infrastructure, the streets, discharge points. We consider impacts from the watershed as well. And also part of that plan is a uniform lot grading plan, a rough grading plan for each individual lot that's being proposed at that first very step. The second step is when the applicant moves forward in their building permitting process. We have a single family site improvement process or program that's part of the building permit, release of the building permit, where we have two inspectors, which they review the site prior to the release of a building permit. They follow up with the tree erosion control inspections, and they also follow back up at the very end of the process for the prior to the certificate of occupancy. Now, the first step, we also have two other stormwater inspectors too that review the land development aspects of this. They have the weekly inspections, and they also are certified BMP stormwater inspectors, and they follow up behind the contractor for the monthly inspection. So the point is twice the same lot gets really reviewed internally, once from the larger big picture, and then again at the more site specific when you review the house, driveway, make sure the specific grading or the individual gradings to going to the inlet and conforming to the land development process. So there's a two-step process there. Now, when it comes to fill, adverse impacts from fill can be attributed to, which is mostly what we see, is just irresponsible grading. When a contractor moves forward without following the grading plan, fills all the way up to the surrounding perimeter property line, cast their stormwater straight off to the adjacent property with disregard. And that's what we run into a lot of the times when we visit sites after people complain. The second one is small depressional areas that get filled. Those areas naturally collect water from the surrounding area. When someone goes and fills in those areas, now you're basically impeding their natural flow, and then it backs up water onto their property. The other is when a land development engineer does not consider the entire basin, what impacts there are downstream, what impacts there are could be upstream from their development, because you're changing the hydrology of a watershed once you install a subdivision. Also, the other adverse impact is we get a lot is the visual appearance. It's just out of character. It's higher for whatever reason than the surrounding properties. And of course, the neighbor's concerned because now, you know, it looks and appears like there's going to be more stormwater coming onto them, which there would not be unless they properly manage the runoff from the roofs and driveways and things like that. So, and then the last one is the unpermitted activity. That's the grading and landscaping that occurs after the building permit when the individual lot owner moves forward with changes to their lot. They usually disrupt somebody on either side, and you usually have to go out and help police that and help solve the problem. Now, on the flip side of that would be some of the things that can properly do to avoid these type of issues is properly grade swales around the perimeter of the parent parcel, making sure that the fill does not exceed beyond the intended perimeter swells that are used to collect and convey stormwater to the inlets. That's a lot of times caught and inspected by our land development site inspectors. The next one is mitigate areas for the natural low depressional areas. If you can't improve capacity downstream, then basically you have to have the same amount of volume on your site to keep from impacting your neighbors. Also, the land development engineer, many times that when you're dealing with much larger multi-phase developments, you do have an engineer that's already got the capabilities and have done this many a times. So they already know about the impacts of peak timings and adjacent property using the same points of discharge and their peak timing of discharge out of their pond. So that does come into some consideration, but most of the time, those elements, you're discharging to the marsh, and those elements are not in play most of the time. And the last one is the home builder. Just work with our storm single-family site improvement program inspectors. Like I said, we have two. They go through approximately 40 permits every week. That includes pools, additions, new home builds, detached units. So a lot of things get caught at their level just because they established a very good relationship with the home builders. The home builders are very focused in on going vertical with their home, but they don't bring that bigger picture. So that's what our inspectors end up doing is they bring a little common sense to what they're doing out in the field, and they're able to offset a lot of the problems. And that program has been a very successful program as far as catching things before they become a problem, just because you bring that perspective to the home site. But I am available for questions at the end of this. I'm going to turn this back over to Kate.
Hey, I got a couple of quick questions, and sir, you know, both stay up there. Just, I don't know what you're getting ready to go to. Two things. In the big picture of things and knowing what's happening with flooding frequency and all that, I'm talking macro, not necessarily site specific in Mount Pleasant, but are these things forward looking enough? For instance, when you go back to the 535 remaining parcels that are, I take it, in a flood zone, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Are we, and the whole purpose of this committee is to be looking 10, 15 years down the road. I agree. I'm not saying that you're wrong, that it's improbable that we would have slab on grade in those areas. But are we thinking forward enough that, 10, 15 years from now, is this town going to want to even let that be an option? If that's something we need to think about, we don't have to make that decision today. But that's what we're here for, and we need to, have y'all's expertise and hopefully our forward thinking to think about those things. The other question I have, because I was in old Mount Pleasant yesterday, not the old village, and I'm a layman, I'm not an engineer, but we know that there are places where a one-story ranch house built in the 50s or 60s has been bought, torn down, and now not only is the house elevated, but it's two floors and then a big roof. Is there a force of physics that stormwater coming off that house, that roof, or down through those downspouts is going faster and farther than it was, including, onto public property or onto neighbor's property, than it was when it was a one-story ranch that was 1,200 feet? We all know what we're talking about in the old parts of Mount Pleasant. Now you got a big house. A lot of them have a detached garage or a breezeway. Some of them have an ADU. And maybe one at a time. These are not a big problem, but I was thinking about these yesterday as I rode past them. When you put them all together, are we going to see more volume, either hopefully not on neighboring properties, but maybe in our own drainage infrastructure? Maybe I'm off base. Maybe that doesn't happen, but I wanted to ask that question.
Yeah, no, that's a fair question.
Okay.
To answer your first one, or try to answer your first one, as far as our projections, things of that nature. We design subdivisions based upon the 100-year storm event, so it's already conservative in nature of setting up the the land development aspects of that. And, you know, we also have emergency overflows and stormwater systems as well. So anything that exceeds the design storm event actually has a release point. So it only is able to get up so high as long as the tide allows it to discharge out and protect the subdivision. So in that aspect, I feel like we're sitting very well as far as conservatively designing our stormwater systems.
To piggyback off that, from a property protection point of view, because Kevin speaks to land development, where floodplain management at a national level is more of a property protection, like looking at the building and life safety. To your point, Mayor, no, we do not have current regulations to stop people from doing that. And the reason that it's improbable is from an elective standpoint. So people are just choosing to do this. Mm-hmm. Is that a fad? Maybe. I don't know. Just like ranch homes in the 1950s and 60s. Are we going to move, either back towards that, whatever, just based on what it looks like in the 30s and 40s, you know, going forward? So that would be up to you guys as council if we need to keep this fad going as a requirement.
It's kind of like when you ride around town, you realize the neighborhoods and big ones that were built without sidewalks, which we don't do that anymore. And for some reason, it was okay in that period in time. And now we wouldn't dream of having neighborhoods without sidewalks. So anyway, keep us on our toes on these forward-looking things that you may need us to, you know, look at taking action on. What your profession is looking at, especially in coastal flood management and stuff. It's the stuff that we need to keep our eye on. Yes.
Just a couple of things. Are we wrapping up?
We got a couple more.
A couple more, and then you have the floor. How about that?
Okay, good.
Do you want to expand on the mayor's second?
I was going to address that second point that you made about the height being physically increasing the volume or the velocity of discharge. There's a lot of truth in that.
Okay.
However, that velocity dissipates in a very short time period.
Okay.
There's from a calculation standpoint, there's no difference between a one-story house and a five-story house. As long as the footprint of the impervious surface is exactly the same, then it all comes out to be the same amount of runoff and the same amount of flow going to the inlet.
Okay.
Now, we can get into splitting hairs about how fast the water is coming out of the downspout, from the height of it, this and that. But once it reaches, you know, outside the downspout, it goes through grass, it goes through the surface, it ends up slowing down very quickly from that. So there's no real, like, hose discharge out of a downspout because of the height of the house. And that, in the same principle, adds that would fill, too. If you can fill in, you know, 2 or 3 inches, where you fill in 3 or 4 feet, same amount of runoff is still generated from that site regardless of the actual vertical height of the improvement. The calculation does not account for vertical height and the amount of runoff. It's the being able to manage it, being able to plan for it, and be able to implement it correctly when you get into these very tight spaces and you get these subdivisions that are very highly dense. That's where we have the challenges, and that's where, you know, we continuously struggle, because a set of plans only takes you so far.
Mm-hmm.
You have to actually go out there and work with the builder to make things work and bring a little common sense to the area and to the project, because both people want, you know, kind of the same thing.
So. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep. And Mayor, your questions segue really great into the latter half of our presentation. So just kind of looking at what the town can do, forward thinking, looking at the state resilience plan, chapter 9 of that plan is recommendations. Two things that stick out for what we can do at a municipal level, because this plan is a statewide plan, so it is geared to what the state can do, you know, at their kind of macro level. But incorporate resilience into planning, land use, and other regulatory processes, and incorporate resilience into infrastructure design, construction, and maintenance. A couple ways that the town already does that. We look at resilience in the comprehensive plan, and like Kevin said, we look at the 1% annual chance flood for design of our infrastructure as well as our structures. Diving more into those based on what the plan says, says we should explore areas to strengthen regulations in flood-prone areas. It's pretty wide, but we can look at from our last presentation, we had a couple of things, and then we have more recommendations after this. Coordinate with state and federal agencies to protecting wetlands. That's something that we could probably strengthen at our municipal level. You know, don't fill the wetlands. Make sure that we have wetlands that are not connected, that we, you know, protect those. They are serving a purpose. And then consider land uses in flood-prone areas, such as emergency response and other critical assets. So not putting a fire station in a place that will flood. Just, you know, looking at other land uses just from that standpoint.
Okay. And before we move on, and you will have the floor, but on this one thing,
yeah,
I guess I'll ask legal. If I remember, a recent Supreme Court decision removed federal jurisdiction from isolated wetlands, or at least some derivation thereof, right? Okay. Does anything prohibit municipalities from protecting isolated wetlands within our boundaries?
Unless it is exempted by state law. So remember, state law preempts.
Right.
It depends on the state law provision, whether there's a complete preemption.
Okay. That's just something to be thinking about, is protecting wetlands, because it may not be important on a macro federal level, but if it's in your neighborhood and it's an isolated wetland and it collects water, you're going to want to preserve it. So.
Yep.
Okay. You got one more? Okay.
Yep, last slide. So just looking at two stormwater management improvements, we can explore the effectiveness of an ordinance to prohibit fill no closer than 10 feet from the perimeter of a subdivision. So parent parcel, just kind of looking at, this was Kevin's idea, to make sure that if we have fill, it's not going right up to that boundary, that we have some more or less a buffer or a setback for fill. And then another recommendation is working with the Green Commission on creating a residential LID program, limiting impervious surface and encouraging nature-based techniques.
Okay.
And that's all I got.
Ms. Corley, you have the...
Oh, I just wanted to, again, you guys do amazing work, and I'm so proud of information that is shared with us once a month, if not more often. But it's almost like we should have had this meeting, what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? We're a bit late. And I know we do a lot, and we're going to continue to do a lot. But I think is there a cost? We're just talking about banning slabs, right? That was the original question, or no?
Well,
wasn't that part of this whole thing?
But that's sort of a first step that the city of Charleston has taken.
I thought we talked about that last month, and that's what, did I miss the boat? Was that was the continuum?
Yeah.
Is that what you understood too?
Yeah. So looking at if that ordinance, what the effect would be on the town, and then if we did something like that, what would be the impact? And then are there other either elements that would be additional or in place of
in
that
place
would be more effective?
And I, that's what I heard as well. But to me, would there be a cost in implementing such a ban? I mean, what would be, just to play it safe? Because I mean, talking about trends, have you guys seen the new, it's like now farmhouses are out and there people are looking at modern cottages, which are not elevated. And you just never know what's going to happen, right? In 10 years. I would feel better putting in such a ban and just getting that so that even if people don't want to do it, but now, you know, long after we're gone, they're not going to be able to.
Jump in on that, to go back to the last slide, what if where we have the Green Commission work and, you know, we have a lot of people with a lot of credentials on there. On new residential low impact development program, what if that is one aspect of that, so that it has, other than just us saying, hey, I don't like fill and build and let's do it, let's take it through there. That's what they're there for, and lend some expertise and let's see what that might look like.
Did we do that last time? No, we didn't send it to the Green Commission last month. Okay.
But this would be, this won't just be fill and build. This is all residential low impact development.
But that's a big part of it. And I didn't see that as an option to ban slab. Was that one of the options or no?
I think we talked about it, and she had numbers. No, was the number of acres 535?
Parcels, so it's less than 300 acres.
Parcels, yep. In the flood zones.
That are undeveloped.
So yes, what we could do is take that a step further, send it to the Green Commission, get them to, within a month, to come back to us and say, this is a good idea or it's a bad idea because. And, you know, even though it's not a tendency today to do the flooding, to fill and build in the slab, maybe we just, if we get their blessing, we just go ahead and do it.
Charleston did it, right?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I don't want to rely on trends. And to say that they're not doing it, I see it everywhere. It's what's going on still. And we have too much of it here. It's caused a lot of problems, I feel. So, I'd rather us have what's reasonable and what we decide is what we want to see and not rely on trends like, oh, we shouldn't talk about this because they probably aren't going to do it anymore. Or what, you know, that's just not the way to operate. So I agree, you know, if we want to send it to the Green Commission. I know Mr. Chapman was hoping that we'd have some conversations with developers and people, but they haven't shown up to participate. But I know they've worked a lot with the city of Charleston, and I feel like we're kind of lucky that a lot of groundwork has been done for the general area when it comes to their opinion on what might be workable.
And they could come with the Green Commission.
Yeah.
They'd come talk to them.
I was hoping last month we'd send it to them, but we didn't. So we should do it now.
Yeah.
I thought we did.
Is residential low impact development guidelines already on there? I think I remember this list. What was on there? Michelle.
Mr. Mayor, we presented the commercial.
Right.
It's already adopted.
Right.
We got feedback from them, and some of the comments was, well, is this a natural step to go into residential?
Right.
And that was one of their already thinking in that direction.
So I think what I hear is this committee would like for the Green Commission to take this up fairly soon. I guess one thing we're talking about is when you're talking about residential low end, you know, that's the whole gamut. That's not just one thing. Should we eliminate fill and build? So we might not get a quick answer on one question, but we might get their input on the whole plethora of low impact development, which, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Do we need a motion from the committee? I guess it wouldn't hurt, would it? Okay. How about a motion to ask the Green Commission to?
I would move that we request that the Green Commission look at the issue of fill and build within the flood zone areas.
And may I ask for them to look at residential low impact development
and to look with a residential low impact development program.
So they don't have to just take up one issue. We have a motion.
One more question.
Okay.
So I know we keep talking about just flood zones, but you let's say that somebody came in and built this neighborhood on slab, they could turn something else into a flood zone. I don't know why we're not looking at the whole picture. Why just focus on flood zone? I know my house wasn't in a flood zone, but now I am. Laura, same thing. I mean, it's affected us personally. So I just think we need to look at it bigger, larger, and not just things that are open, but redevelopment and not just flood zones.
Okay.
Is that?
That would be the whole low impact development.
Yeah.
Residential.
So, okay. Howard's got a motion. We need a second. We have a second. Any further discussion?
Mm-hmm.
All right. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The ayes have it. Thank you all very much. If there's nothing else, that completes our agenda, and we will stand adjourned.